From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Memento is one of the most successful independent films of the year. This thriller about memory and identity is still playing in many theaters and comes out on video and DVD in early September. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Memento's screenwriter and director, Christopher Nolan. A new box set collects the music of the group Buffalo Springfield, which was co-founded in 1966 by Neil Young, Stephen Stills, and Richie Furay. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the group, and we feature an interview with Neil Young. And John Powers reviews Woody Allen's new movie, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. In McAllen, Texas, a high-profile lawsuit against Firestone Tires has been settled for an undisclosed amount, though there are reports it was $7.5 million. The lawsuit launched by the family of Marisa Rodriguez, who was paralyzed in an accident involving Firestone Tires. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from McAllen, Texas.
Lawyers for the Rodriguez family approached Firestone's legal team just after the jury in the case began its third day of deliberations. One family lawyer said there were concerns in their camp that the jury wouldn't be able to reach a decision and the case would have to start all over again. Still, lawyers from both sides said they were satisfied with the outcome. Firestone attorneys said they felt they had made the case that the Ford Explorer had design flaws which played a role in the accident. And family lawyers say the public has a better idea about problems with Firestone tires. Most of the plaintiff's lawyers now move on to hundreds of other similar lawsuits still pending against both the tire company and Ford. Jackie Northam, NPR News, McAllen, Texas.
President Bush has chosen a man with a background in space defense to lead the nation's armed services. Air Force General Richard Myers was named to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Air Force said today a locking pin installed backward during manufacture caused a missile fin to fall off in flight over Florida. The fin nearly hit two children walking in their neighborhood. The unarmed missile was slung beneath the wing of an F-16 Fighting Falcon when the 10-pound wing dropped off. The accident happened while the jet fighter was making a landing approach at Elgin in the Air Force, the Florida Panhandle, earlier this month. No one was hurt and there was no property damage. Most of the fires burning in eastern Washington have stopped growing, while crews quickly try to complete fire lines before hotter, drier weather moves into the region this weekend. From member station KUOW, Patricia Murphy reports.
Rain across Washington has slowed fire growth and allowed crews to gain the upper hand on most of the state's seven wildfires, which have burned 150,000 acres so far. Firefighters are moving quickly to snuff out fires before hotter weather returns to the region this weekend. A battalion of U.S. Army soldiers is temporarily trading rifles for pickaxes to relieve weary firefighters who've been battling the blazes for well over a week. Members of the Army Task Force will be doing mop-up and support. The soldiers don't have the experience needed by federal, tribal, and state firefighting crews, so they won't be sent to the fire's front lines. Meantime, major new wildfires were reported in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, with strong winds hindering firefighting efforts there. For NPR News, I'm Patricia Murphy in Seattle.
A new judge has been appointed in the Microsoft antitrust case. Judge Colleen Coler-Catelli will have to decide what penalty Microsoft should pay for violating antitrust laws. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 194 points today, closing at 10,423 on volume of a billion shares. The Nasdaq was up 74 at 1916. This is NPR News. NATO will now send a total of 4,500 troops to Macedonia. That's 1,000 more soldiers than previously announced. Over half of the British-led brigade is now on the ground in the southern Balkan country. They'll carry out an initial 30-day mission to collect weapons from ethnic Albanian militants. NPR's Guy Raz reports from the capital, Skopje.
NATO officials now say they will collect about 3,000 weapons from the rebels, but the Macedonian government insists that figure is too low. Still, NATO-led peacekeepers will neither force rebels to give up their arms nor search for weapons. The 4,500-strong NATO brigade will set up 15 weapons collection depots across Macedonia early next week. The first weapons handover will take place on Monday. The ethnic Albanian militants who launched an insurgency against the Macedonian government last February say they will honor a commitment to disarm, but they're calling on the government to speed up promised political reforms, which will grant the country's ethnic Albanian minority greater civil rights. The rebels say they took up arms to highlight the status of ethnic Albanians in Macedonia. The government calls them separatists. Guy Raz, NPR News, Skopje.
President Bush today laid blame for the recent fighting in the Middle East squarely on the shoulders of the Palestinians. At a news conference in Texas, the president said Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat could do a better job trying to stop the terrorist activity in the region. Mr. Bush also urged Israel to show restraint, but stopped short of criticizing the Jewish state for launching an invasion last night to the West Bank city of Hebron, which is mainly under Palestinian control. Two military planes crashed today in North Texas. Officials say at least two crew members parachuted safely. So far, no information on a third person seen parachuting out of one of the planes. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The film Memento is one of the biggest independent hits of the year. It opened last winter and is still playing in many theaters. The film cost $5 million to produce and has grossed around $25 million. It comes out on video and DVD September 4th. Christopher Nolan wrote and directed Memento. We spoke when the movie opened last winter. Memento is a thriller whose real subject is memory and identity. It stars Guy Pearce as Leonard Shelby, a man with a rare form of amnesia. He's been unable to make new memories ever since he was struck on the head while his wife was raped and murdered. He's obsessed with finding the murderer and getting revenge, but how do you keep track of the clues you uncover? How can you even be sure what you're doing if you have no memory? In his pursuit of the killer, Leonard has moved into a cheap motel. Here he is talking with the desk clerk.
I'm Mr. Shelby from 304.
All right, what can I do for you, Leonard?
Bert, I'm not sure. I think I may have asked you to hold my calls.
You don't know?
Well, I think I may have. I'm not too good on the phone.
Right, you said you like to look people in the eye when you talk to them.
Yeah.
You don't remember saying that.
Well, that's the thing. I have this condition.
A condition?
It's my memory.
Amnesia.
No. It's different from that. I have no short-term memory. I know who I am. I know all about myself. Since my injury, I can't make new memories. Everything fades. If we talk for too long, I'll forget how we started. And next time I see you, I'm not going to remember this conversation. I don't even know if I've met you before. So if I seem a little strange or rude or something, I've told you this before, haven't I?
Yeah, I don't mean to mess with you, but it's so weird. You don't remember me at all.
No.
We've talked a bunch of times.
I'm sure we have, yeah.
Well, what's the last thing you remember?
My wife.
What's it like?
It's like waking. It's like you just woke up.
For his work on Memento, Christopher Nolan was named British Screenwriter of the Year by the London Film Critics Circle. He based his screenplay on a story by his brother Jonathan. This is Nolan's second film. His first, Following, played film festivals and got limited distribution in the States. Christopher Nolan, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to describe Leonard's memory disorder in Memento.
Leonard's memory disorder in Memento, it's anterior grade memory loss. It's a form of amnesia whereby you can't make new memories. You know everything about yourself. You know all the supposedly objective information about, you know, who you were and, you know, your name and who you grew up with and who you were married to and where you lived and all this stuff. Up until a particular point where through, in his case, some kind of trauma, you know, blow to the head, he's lost the ability to make new memories. So he's been sort of cut adrift in a sense, in, you know, time, because he's lost his sense of time passing, and in space, because he doesn't know where he is, because he doesn't know how he's got someplace.
I think what I like most about the film is that Leonard is just a more extreme version of how I live my life. Like, I tell friends things several times, forgetting that I've already told them. My memory is often so unreliable. I write notes to myself. I email myself. I leave phone messages for myself. Leonard actually tattoos his body with lists of facts that he has to remember. Things like, find him and kill him.
Well, that was exactly my interest in the condition. I mean, the screenplay was based on a short story that my younger brother was writing. And basically what fascinated me about the condition and about then writing the screenplay from it is that I saw him not as a freak. You know, I wasn't interested in making any kind of medical drama. I saw an interesting jumping off point for an exaggeration of the process by which we all live, the process of memory, the process of taking present tense information and passing it into the long-term memory. I saw a very interesting jumping off point for an examination of that process and how fragile and inefficient it is. And as I wrote the script, I simply exaggerated the way I live my life. You know, I tend to keep the same things in the same pockets so I don't have to think about, you know, where I put my house keys or my glasses and so forth. And I became sort of fascinated by the idea that if I were to tell you a string of 12 numbers right now, you know, 30 seconds later, you probably wouldn't be able to recite it back to me. Once you start looking at it in that detail, it becomes a little bit frightening.
Describe some of the devices you've given Leonard to help him remember what he's just experienced and what he's just learned.
Well, the most visual device, obviously, is the tattoos, which he uses his body to record essential information, clues about the guy who killed his wife, because he's looking for the guy who killed his wife. He's looking for revenge. The more everyday things are, he uses a Polaroid camera. He carries one with him at all times, and he snaps Polaroids of the car he drives, the place he's staying, and the people he's encountering, and he writes notes to himself about these people on the backs of these pictures, and he has a sort of chart on his wall where he sticks this information when he's done with it, you know, when he comes back to his hotel room and so forth. So these are the kind of devices he uses. But the main one actually is that some people miss when they're watching the film, funnily enough, is a form of sort of behavior modification called conditioning, which is where you sort of use a different part of the brain to try and retain information. It's your sort of muscle memory. And what you do is you pattern your behavior and you use habit and routine to systematize your behavior to the extent that you stop having to use your conscious mind to operate.
I want to play another scene from the film, and this scene is really about how we're defined by memory. And this scene is Guy Pearce and Joe Pantoliano.
What about John G? You think he's still here?
Who?
Johnny G, the guy you're looking for. I mean, that's why you haven't left town, am I right?
Maybe.
Leonard, look, you have to be very careful.
Why?
The other day you mentioned that maybe somebody was trying to set you up, get you to kill the wrong guy.
Oh, well, I go on facts, not recommendations, but thank you.
Lenny, you can't trust a man's life to your little notes and pictures.
Why not?
Because your notes could be unreliable.
Memory's unreliable.
Oh, please.
No, really. Memory's not perfect. It's not even that good. Ask the police. Eyewitness testimony is unreliable. The cops don't catch a killer by sitting around remembering stuff.
Right.
They collect facts.
That's not what I'm saying.
They make notes and they draw conclusions. Facts, not memories. That's how you investigate. I know. It's what I used to do. Look, memory can change the shape of a room. It can change the color of a car. And memories can be distorted. They're just an interpretation. They're not a record. And they're irrelevant if you have the facts.
You really want to get this guy, don't you?
Killed my wife. He took away my memory. He destroyed my ability to live.
That's a scene from Memento. My guest, Christopher Nolan, wrote and directed the movie. Can you talk about how you connect memory and identity in the film?
Well, for me, when my brother Jonah, when he told me this story or this idea for a story that he was working on, what he pointed out to me and I immediately responded to is that it's not an amnesia story. And the reason that was sort of interesting to us is because amnesia stories have no rules, in a sense. If you wipe out the identity of the character by wiping out his long-term memory, you then can make this character anybody, you know, you want to. It becomes a very easy device in the story. I mean, there have been some great amnesia thrillers, but I mean, what we were drawn to with this condition is that you know all of the information that you're supposed to be able to use to identify yourself. You know your name, your social security number, who you were married to, where you went to school, where you lived, all this stuff. Up to this point, you know, in Leonard's case, relatively, you know, late in his development, if you like, when he's lost the ability to make new memories. So the question of identity is sort of boiled down not to this, it's not this wider question of who am I? I could be anybody. It's, to me, a more relevant question, certainly relevant to me approaching the age of 30 as I was when I made it, this question of who am I now and how does that relate to who I was 10 years ago? You know, how did I get here sort of thing? To us, that was a much more interesting identity question. And, you know, there's certainly, you know, an element of, I don't know, satire, if you like, in the way that, you know, Leonard's primary identifiers are, you know, the clothes he wears and the cars he drives. And, you know, that was kind of interesting to us as a device as well.
I think I understand why you were so intrigued by the idea of a revenge story about somebody with memory loss. I mean, crime films are often about someone obsessed with seeking revenge for having been double-crossed in the past, or revenge for a loved one who was murdered. So it's the memory of this double-cross or this crime that leads to obsession mm-hmm. with revenge. And, of course, the paradox here is that, you know, your character's memory of his wife's murder leads to his obsession with revenge, and yet he's lost all subsequent memory.
Yes, and so, you know, and this was Jonah's fascination with the material, and I it certainly played right into the movie, is he's trapped in the moment of the aftermath of this trauma. As he says at one point in the film, you know, how can you heal if you can't feel time? He can't feel time passing because he's lost the ability to process information. So he's not aware of how long it is since his wife was killed and so forth. And that seemed a very, very tragic, but very extraordinary situation for a character, that he'd be stuck in this moment of grief and anger.
One of the characters says to Leonard, who's so obsessed with revenge, even if you get revenge, you won't remember. Your movie is not only about memory. Your movie relies on the audience's memory, which it needs to follow a pretty complicated plot.
Well, it's actually a very, very simple plot. But the notion is to tell it in such a way that you have to view it the way Leonard views it. And to Leonard, even a relatively simple story such as makes up Memento becomes incredibly complicated, viewed the way he has to view it and pieced together the way he has to piece it together.
Why don't you describe the structure of the narrative, how everything happens in reverse?
Yeah, the film is structured pretty much literally in reverse. We begin with the end of the story, if you like, or the end of the chronological sequence, and then each subsequent scene is a flashback further in time from the previous scene. So we jump further and further back in time. And this material is all in color. And then between these color sequences, we have these little black and white scenes coming in that actually run forwards in time, as you sort of learn in the film. And they provide more objective information about this guy. They kind of show Leonard from more of a bird's eye view, more of a kind of documentary view of him. And these kind of separate the subsequent flashbacks further and further in time, and also give us a little more information about the character we're looking at.
Now, you mentioned the black and white scenes versus the color scenes and how mm-hmm. the black and white go forward, whereas the color scenes go in reverse chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
It actually took me a while to notice that.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you wanted that to work on people consciously or subconsciously.
My ideal viewer, if you like, who's watching the film, kind of picks up on that, you know, some point in the second reel or third reel. And but, you know, I wanted to construct the film in such a way that you don't need to know that at all, and you can kind of figure that out, you know, an hour after you've left the film, or, you know, if you're interested enough to see it a second time, sort of notice it a second time. So it's certainly not essential. What's essential is to realize that the color sequences are moving back in time. That helps orient, you know, the viewer as they watch it, so that it's not a random sequence of events and it's not completely cyclical. There are kind of echoes and cycles within the film, but the overall thrust of it is backwards in time.
Let's talk about the casting. The lead in your movie, the man who has lost most of his memory but is seeking revenge for the murder of his wife, is Guy Pearce, who our listeners might remember as the kind of seemingly straight-laced by the book cop in L.A. Confidential, and he was also in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. Did you ask for Guy Pearce, or did he come to you?
Well, both, really. It sort of worked out quite well, because what I was really looking for was an actor who would see the potential of, you know, what they could do with this character, and obviously an actor of extraordinary talent, because, you know, this is a character who's in every single scene of the movie. I mean, the story is entirely told from his point of view, And Guy was brought to my attention by the producers, and I had never really put together the actor from Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, with the actor in L.A. Confidential. And once I took a look at those two films and saw this actor who could do both of these things, I thought, well, you know, any actor who can pull off both of those characters can do absolutely anything he sets his mind to. And we got the script to Guy, and when I met him, you know, he wanted to meet right away, which is always a good sign. And when I met him, it was very clear that he'd really connected with the material. He'd really connected with the character. This is a character who is constantly pretending that he knows what's going on when he doesn't. He's constantly feeling emotions that are carrying over from an experience that he can no longer remember. So he feels the emotion, but not the conscious reason behind it, not the narrative reason behind it, if you like. And I think Guy had seen a way of tapping into that. And what he also brought to the table was he's an incredibly logical, minded performer. He won't do anything that doesn't make sense to him. So he became an incredible logic filter on the material, because I was determined that the film should sustain the close scrutiny that its bizarre structure kind of invites. And he was very helpful in making sure that everything really holds together.
Christopher Nolan wrote and directed the thriller Memento. It comes out on video and DVD September 4th. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview we recorded earlier this year with Christopher Nolan, the screenwriter and director of the independent film hit Memento. Why do you make movies? What do you love about watching movies and making them?
I think the various different things I love about it. I've always loved films. I started making films when I was 7 years old and kind of haven't stopped. And I've never really thought about doing anything else. What I love is films that create their own particular geography, their own particular world, and kind of immerse you in it for a couple hours. And I've always been a huge fan of Ridley Scott, and certainly when I was a kid, I mean, Alien and Blade Runner, I just blew me away because they just created these extraordinary worlds that were so terribly, you know, just completely immersive. I've also always been an enormous Stanley Kubrick fan for similar reasons. And then I think as I got older, I got more interested in films that I hadn't grown up with, the sort of cinema of people like Nicholas Roeg and Sidney Lumet and John Frankenheimer, people like that.
When you were making movies as a child, what were you making them about?
Well, I started off with my older brother Matt sort of doing kind of sort of war movies with, you know, action figures and all the rest. And then when I was about 7, Star Wars came out and kind of changed everything. And so everything I did after that was sort of little spaceships flying around and, you know, short films imaginatively titled Space Wars and things like that. But had a lot of fun doing that over the years. And actually the guys, I was living in Chicago at the time when I was 8 years old, and I made films with these two brothers, Rocco and Adrian Belich, and they made their first film just when I did, their first feature film, when I made my first feature film following, and we were on the festival circuit together. It was a documentary they made called Genghis Blues that they actually wound up getting an Academy Award nomination for last year, which was a wonderful kind of serendipity that we kind of wound up, you know, going out there with our first films when we sort of made these little science fiction epics when we were kids.
Just one last question about memory, since that's really the subject of your movie Memento. Is there anything in your life that you really wish you could conjure up a full memory of, either visually or factually, that's just kind of been erased over the years and you can't grasp it much as you desperately want to?
Well, after writing the screenplay for Memento, I have to be honest, I actually feel that way about almost all my memories, because what I realized about myself, and I think it applies to other people as well, is that the process of creating long-term memories is very similar to the process of remembering a dream. And it's you wake up in the morning and you you know, lie there in bed and you can remember the dream, and you can remember it in a sensual sense. You can actually recreate the dream in your mind. But as you do that, you turn it into words, you turn it into language, both visual language and verbal language. And so it becomes a set of symbols in your long-term memory. You know, it's very much like the process of, as I say, remembering a dream and then trying to explain it to someone else. And then all you're left with really is the kind of symbolic representation of something you experienced. And after going through the process of making Memento, it seems increasingly true to me that other than these tiny little glimpses of sense memory to do with smell and particular, you know, visual references and all the rest, the tiny little details of a person that you remember, much of it is very elusive and very artificial.
Now, in the face of that knowledge, are you trying desperately to keep journals and to photograph things and sketch things so that you will have as accurate a memory as you're capable of keeping? Or do you just accept the fact that everything you experience is kind of fleeting in its own way and you can't really grasp it forever?
I've actually sort of accepted the fleeting nature a little bit and kind of done less of you know, the trying to remember things or trying to record things. Just before I made Memento, as an exercise, partly just to sort of keep myself visually in tune, I started taking a single photograph every day of my life, and I did this for about a year leading up to making Memento, and it was a photograph of anything, just a tiny little detail of something in my apartment or outside. And I was doing it for visual reasons. I wanted to discipline myself to take a single frame and create an interesting image with that, just taking one single frame every day. And, you know, I sort of put together this book of a tiny little visual detail for every day. And, you know, that was the process I was kind of going through in terms of while I was writing the screenplay and exploring memory. And since making the film and since kind of dealing with that in such detail, I've really kind of relaxed about that, and it's a long time since I actually took any pictures of anything. So unfortunately, all my experience now is just kind of getting lost as it happens. But, you know, that's fine.
Well, Christopher Nolan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Nolan wrote and directed the film Memento. Our interview was recorded last March when Memento was released. It's still playing in many theaters and comes out on video and DVD September 4th. Nolan is making a new movie called Insomnia, starring Al Pacino and Hilary Swank. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Book Magazine, for the passionate reader, featuring books, authors, and articles that read between the lines, in bookstores and online at bookmagazine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's Neil Young playing fuzz-tone guitar on the Buffalo Springfield recording Every Days. A new box set collects the group's recordings from the 60s. Coming up, Edward profiles Buffalo Springfield, and we listen back to an interview with Neil Young. Also, John Powers reviews Woody Allen's new movie.
Saturday's child stays home, nothing to say, it's so wrong. Well, 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 another day. Grocery store, ten clerks, just making change, plastic jerks. Up in a tree, a jaybird, yelling at me, no words, everyone looks, can't see, can be ignored easily.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may be simplistic to call the Buffalo Springfield America's answer to the Beatles, but the band did produce a number of brilliant careers after its short life ended. Bootlegs have circulated for years, but now the band's definitive summing up has arrived. Today, armed with the new Buffalo Springfield box set, rock historian Ed Ward tells their story.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Nobody involved seems to remember just how it was the Buffalo Springfield came together, although they all agree the band was named after a steamroller. Stephen Stills and Richie Furay were members of the Ogogo Singers, a supper club folk act. And while on tour in Canada, they met Neil Young, son of a famous sports writer and a guy who went back and forth between solo performance and being in a band called the Mina Birds with bassist Bruce Palmer and a black American singer named Rick James. The Mina Birds collapsed, and Young and Palmer took off for Hollywood to be discovered. It was 1966, a good year for that.
Who's that stomping all over my face? Where's that silhouette I'm trying to trace? Who's putting sponge in the bells I once rung and taking my gypsy before she's begun to sing in the meaning of what's in my mind before I can take home what's rightfully mine? Join in and listening and talking in a rhyme, stopping sing.
Unfortunately, fame didn't come to the two Canadians, so they decided to strike out for San Francisco, where they'd heard good things were happening. They got into Neil's old hearse and were driving down Sunset Boulevard when Stills and Furay, driving in the other direction, saw them. Only one person would have a hearse with Ontario plates, Stills reasoned, so he had Furay turn them around and chase the car. The four went somewhere to jam, and a band was born. Their first success was Nowadays Clancy Can't Even Sing, one of Neil Young's songs, with Furay and Stills singing, and it sounded good enough that they quickly started writing. Soon they had a drummer, another Canadian named Dewey Martin, and managers with a track record. They also managed Sonny and Cher, and before long it signed the Buffalo Springfield to Atco Records. Clancy was released as a single and went nowhere, but there was an album on the way.
Been burned and with both feet on the ground. I've learned that it's painful coming down. No use running away, and there's no time left to stay. Now I'm finding out that it's so confusing. No time left, and I know I'm.
The album, entitled Buffalo Springfield, was filled with brilliant songs, played with an offhand virtuosity that sounded easy. And right after it was released, Stills was on his way to the Sunset Strip and found his way blocked by turmoil, the famous Sunset Strip riots. He went home, and about 10 minutes later, he'd written For What It's Worth, which became the band's biggest and only hit. Unfortunately, Charlie Green and Brian Stone, their managers, fancied themselves record producers, and the first album was marred by horrible sound. That was just the first of the problems that would doom this great band. The second was a trip to New York, where Bruce Palmer got busted for pot and deported. The band continued to record and write, however, but in May 1967, Neil Young quit, claiming his work wasn't appreciated in the band. Palmer rejoined, and a couple of months later, so did Young.
Every time you touch her, set your hands on fire. Is all that she requires, and you hang on, hang on, hang on to the words of love.
band recorded group material like that on the first album, like this rough take of a Neil Young song, Down to the Wire, more and more, the second album was looking like a series of solo projects pressed onto one record.
Listen to my bluebird laugh. She can't tell you why. Deep within her heart, you see, she knows all I cry.
Stephen Stills' Bluebird was a guitar duel standout of their live show, and condensing it to 4.5 minutes on record made it all the more powerful, especially when someone had the brilliant idea of tacking on a banjo coda at the end. As for Neil Young, he was hanging out with L.A.'s pop avant-garde, including a brilliant arranger named Jack Nitzsche. Only member of the Buffalo Springfield on Expecting to Fly, and from the demos he was recording at this time, it seems clear he was heading out in another direction from the rest of the band.
Don't call Pretty Peggy, she can't hear you no more. Don't leave no message round her back door. They say the old laughing lady been here before. While she don't keep time, she don't count score.
But a second album, entitled Buffalo Springfield Again, finally did come out, with Bluebird, Expecting to Fly, and another Neil Young avant-garde opus, Broken Arrow. Buffalo Springfield Again should have been their big break, but once again the law got Bruce Palmer, and this time he stayed in Canada. Jim Messina, a studio technician who'd been around while they were recording the second album, took over on bass and helped them compile tracks for a third album. But the band had lost too much money, and as 1968 drew on, it was clear Buffalo Springfield couldn't continue. A final album called Last Time Around came out, but the band had already scattered by the time it did, and Neil Young and Jack Nitzsche were already recording Neil's first solo album. Buffalo Springfield had only lasted 25 months, but they'd set a standard few bands have approached since.
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed a new box set of the band Buffalo Springfield. Coming up, an interview with Neil Young about his early career, including his days with Buffalo Springfield. This is Fresh Air. Now that the Buffalo Springfield box set has been released, we're going to listen back to an interview with Neil Young, in which he talked about his early career, including his work with Buffalo Springfield. First, here's Neil Young singing Buffalo Springfield Again from last year's CD, Silver and Gold. I spoke with Neil Young in 1992. You were in high school bands. Did you sing in those bands?
After the beginning, I did. I started as an instrumentalist. We used to do songs, instrumentals that I used to write, you know, melodies and play them on a guitar, sort of like a group called The Shadows from England. And then after the English invasion, you know, and also about the same time as Jimmy Reed became popular, the old blues man Jimmy Reed with going to New York and...
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, Beeping and Hiding and all these things, you know, he about the same time as the British invasion, all these groups singing harmony and playing guitars and everything. Both of those things happened to me at once, so I really couldn't figure out who it was that made me want to sing, but one of them, you know, or both of them at the same time. And I started singing, and that was like a milestone.
What do you mean?
People couldn't believe it, apparently. I don't remember it, but I was so into it, I guess I didn't notice that everybody was going, what is that? You know, as I was starting to sing. Of course, now I'm like, you know, Caruso or something. Got it down.
Were you self-conscious about your voice when you started to sing?
No, not really. I never really, I was just glad to be singing. I mean, we could do a lot more songs if I sang them.
No one else in the band could sing?
No. Nobody in the band could sing. Not nobody else in the band. Nobody in the band. So we did harmony, and we did everything, you know, but it didn't matter.
Now, you say that you weren't self-conscious about your singing, but there are stories about how, you know, like in your first solo album, you intentionally mixed yourself in the background.
No, I mixed myself right up there where I should be, and then they tried out this new scientific process that they'd invented called the CSG Heiko-Cog process, which is this unbelievable thing where you can make a stereo record play back on a mono machine just like it was a mono record. They did something to the sound back then. This is when stereo was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, a lot of people had mono sets, and the stereo didn't sound right on the mono set. So they came out with this thing. You run it through this machine that this guy made, this little box or something, and it would make it so you could play it both stereo or mono. But in reality, I was a test case for this with my first album. They did this without letting me know. And they put it out like that, and I got the pressings back, and I went, what happened, you know? Then I read this thing that had been added on the album cover where this, with this engineering note that this had employed this technique. And really, it was the worst thing I ever heard. I mean, they just buried the whole center of the record and put it way down. And this, I think they only used it on my record. They decided it didn't work after that.
So it wasn't self-consciousness that was behind
it? No.
That.
I can look at the next record. My vocal is right up there.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about being in a tight harmony group like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young?
How did they feel about it? That's the question. It was no longer a tight harmony group.
Do you like being in a harmony like that? I mean, I love your voice. I consider it a very personal voice. Do you know what I mean? A voice that should be singing on its own more so than just like mixed in a harmony.
Well, you know, I like singing harmony too. I sing good harmony with Crazy Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in there that, you know, because there's a couple of different ways to sing harmony, you know, and you can, or blends of all of them. But one of them is just real tight harmony, and the other one is where everybody's singing just more or less just singing loose, but in a harmonic structure with a lot of feeling. That's a different kind of harmony, and that's the kind of harmony that I do with Crazy Horse quite a bit. Sometimes we're real successful at that.
So you came from Canada to Los Angeles. Became part of Buffalo Springfield, and I guess it was in '66. You have a really big hit for What It's Worth, and then you know people just like loved Buffalo Springfield. This is like the height or the beginnings of the height of the whole kind of counterculture, which is really thriving, particularly on the West Coast. And so suddenly, like you're really in the thick of it. I mean, you'd gone from what, a small town in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a half a million people, something like that.
Uh-huh. And now like you're really in the thick of it. Did you change a lot? Were you like a kind of different person than you were?
Well, you know, I think it affected me. I think it got to be a lot of pressure for a while. But, you know, we got through that after freaking out and quitting the band a couple of times and you know, throwing my guitar against the chair and doing all kinds of stuff. You know, I went through a normal kind of teenage to adult changeover period there.
When you throw your guitar against the chair, do you? In the days when you did that, were you sure you had money to replace it?
No, that was the
point. Before you threw it?
No. No, I think I didn't do that every day, but it's just part, I guess, the pressure of being in the band and trying to make things happen. Yeah. We did a lot of things like that. I mean, we were 20, 21 years old. We were kind of crazy for a while, and then, you know, just like anybody else under a lot of pressure. Bunch of kids, you know. It's a pretty fast-moving time.
What's something that you look back on and still find really exciting about that period?
Well, the music was great, and it's too bad it was never recorded correctly, or the Buffalo Springfield would have been far more of a memory than they are now.
What's missing?
The music is missing. There was, you know, this was about the time when people started making records by overdubbing, and new technology was coming in. We had like 8 tracks and we had ways of doing things that made it possible to layer records. And so instead of going in the studio and singing live, like we were so great live, the people producing us, they didn't record us the way they should have. If they had just set us up and let us record live, this band would be, the band probably would have been together and stayed together a lot longer, because we would have had much more success and had a lot more happiness from listening to our records, and you know, felt like we were getting something done. But at the beginning, it was kind of hard to break through. We still didn't know how to make records, and we didn't have anybody that knew how to make records helping us make records. And instead, we had people who wanted to be record producers for one reason or another, who were there, but really weren't doing anything. Nobody strong came along and said, listen, you guys go in there and sing, and when I tell you to come out and stop playing and singing, then come on in here and it'll sound great. Nobody ever did that. So I feel that was a failing of the Buffalo Springfield, was all the records. There was only Ahmed Erdogan really had a grip on what should be... what the Springfield records should sound like.
What sounds best to you now from those records?
I don't have a favorite.
Okay. I thought I'd play Mr. Soul. What are your memories of that?
Well, the memories of that are the best take of it and the best mix of it and the best version of it is somewhere in the Atlantic vault.
Right.
And the one that we're listening to here is one that where we got away from it, and we kept overdubbing and overdubbed guitar parts and added things over top of the original stuff and lost some of the original stuff. And we took it too far. We didn't have anybody to tell us to go home or tell us that had experience telling us what to do. So we lost a lot of the great stuff that we had on tape in the first place, or that we never got a lot of it on tape at all.
Okay, well, in the meantime, we'll satisfy ourselves with the actually released version of Mr. Soul. Our interview with Neil Young was recorded in 1992. A new box set collects the Buffalo Springfield recordings from the 60s. It includes this alternate take of Mr. Soul, which was selected for inclusion on the box set by Neil Young. Coming up, John Powers reviews Woody Allen's new movie, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion. This is Fresh Air. Woody Allen's new movie, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion, stars Allen, Helen Hunt, and Dan Aykroyd. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Back when he was making Sleeper, Annie Hall in Manhattan, which is to say more than two decades ago, a new Woody Allen movie was something to get excited about. Now it's an occasion for dread. I drive to the theater with a sinking heart, knowing exactly what I'm going to get. Black and white credits with music by someone like George Gershwin, a slack plot in which Woody's character is made to look silly, or even nasty, but is ultimately vindicated. And of course, some flesh-crawling scene in which a hot young babe wants to have sex with him. You know what I'm talking about, and I suspect that he does too, not that it makes any difference. His new movie, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion, is quintessential late-period Allen, though with a better calibrated plot. It's set in 1940, radio days, you might say, and finds Woody starring as C.W. Briggs, a claims investigator for a fading insurance company. C.W.'s bete noire is Betty Ann Fitzgerald, that's Helen Hunt, an efficiency expert who hates his old-style ways, especially his taste for brainless broads. But when they go to an office party at a nightclub, C.W. gets hypnotized by Voltan, a magician played by David Ogden Stiers. The crooked Voltan uses his hypnotic power to get C.W. to rob the company's clients, and soon C.W.'s in a mess, investigating crimes he himself has unwittingly committed, fending off the sexual advances of a sexy heiress played by Charlize Theron, and engaging in a protracted love-hate relationship with Betty Ann. Here, the two meet at a bar.
I don't think you know what you're talking about. I think you came in here like a steamroller and...
You felt threatened by me from the first day I got on this job. Not only was I an efficiency expert and a challenge to your little state within a state, but I'm not one of those wind-up dolls you can tickle at the water cooler. I'm smarter than you. I'm faster. I can see right through you. You're right to feel threatened by me.
I am threatened by you?
It's fascinating, as a female executive, how many men I meet with a fragile masculinity.
A fragile masculinity? You make one more crack about my religion and woman or no woman.
I have to go.
Hey, listen, honey, let me level with you here. Despite all your highfalutin talk about streamlining the office, what you really need is a good old-fashioned roll in the hay.
Huh. You wouldn't know which end is up.
Well, in your case, it would be hard to tell.
Don't bother seeing me to the door. Someone might think we're together.
Why, do I look like an organ grinder?
No, just an organ.
It doesn't get any better than this. Truly, that's one of the funniest scenes in The Curse of the Jade Scorpion. It's not unpleasant to watch, really, but it is stale. C.W. and Betty Ann aren't so much characters as vessels for Allen's trademark humor, dialogue whose one-liners and rhythms are now so reflexive they've become an artistic prison. If Allen ever made a Planet of the Apes movie, the monkeys would all talk exactly like Woody. Allen's familiar gags might feel less tired if they actually had something to say about the world. Back in his golden days, Allen's work did. He made timely jokes about Marshall McLuhan, offered an ironic romanticism perfectly attuned to its era, and displayed an interest in radio days that was more than just nostalgic. But over the years, his engagement with the larger world vanished, and the main interest of an Allen movie became how he would tinker with his own image, how he would justify himself after the fiasco with Mia Farrow and Sun Yi, how he would find a way to still play the lady killer, now that most women look at him as if he were their grandfather, old and not a little gamey. In all this, he was a far cry from Clint Eastwood, whose movies also dealt with his own image, but were about more than just himself. Eastwood used his iconic status to explore the complications of being male, the violence, the guilty fears, the struggles with aging. He grew more open as he got older. Alan has just gotten older. And what's saddest about his work now is its lack of passion. Year after year, his films keep coming out, and some are marginally better than the others. Manhattan Murder Mystery had some exuberance. Deconstructing Harry at least tried to be ambitious. But none seem inspired by anything more compelling than the fact that he's used to doing them. The way other people light up a cigarette or have a cocktail, Alan now makes movies. And what's left of his audience goes to see them for much the same reason. Not in the expectation of another Annie Hall, but out of nervous habit.
John Powers is executive editor of LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again, a novel by Elizabeth McCracken, the author of The Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Oh, Aretha! Can you feel the spirit?
On the next Fresh Air, we kick off a week of great soul singers, songwriters, and producers with Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for Soul Music Week on Fresh Air.